I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the UN Secretary General responds to Assad's peace proposal for Syria. Pope Benedict calls for a halt to the slaughter of civilians in Syria. Human Rights Watch speaks out against a Bahrain court decision.
We are shocked. We are shocked that a military court can convict dissidents only for exercising their right to free expression.
And jitters in Israel over President Obama's nominee for defense secretary. It's all ahead. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon Monday voiced his disappointment over Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's speech Sunday, in which he called for a political solution to the civil war. Mr. Assad said he is prepared to hold a national reconciliation conference as part of a political process towards elections and a new constitution. But he said the talks would exclude anyone who he says betrayed Syria. The Syrian leader said Syria is at war with its enemies and denied facing a popular revolution. Mr. Assad repeated his long-standing description of the rebels as al-Qaeda terrorists bent on tearing up the country, and he demanded that Western and regional powers stop funding and arming them. He also dismissed the exiled Syrian opposition coalition as a Western puppet. Martin Nisirki is UN Secretary General Ban's spokesman.
What the Syrian people desperately need at this time are real solutions to the crisis that is tearing their nation apart. In this regard, the Secretary General was disappointed that the speech by President Bashar al-Assad on the 6th of January does not contribute to a solution that could end the terrible suffering of the Syrian people. The speech rejected the most important element of the Geneva communique of the 30th of June 2012, namely a political transition and the establishment of a transitional governing body with full executive powers that would include representatives of all Syrians. The United Nations remains committed to do its utmost in cooperation with other partners to alleviate the suffering of the Syrian people inside and outside Syria. The United Nations will also continue to help the people of Syria fulfill their legitimate aspirations for peace, dignity, freedom, justice, and democracy in a united and sovereign Syria. The Secretary General reaffirms his long-held view that there is no military solution to the conflict in Syria. The Secretary General and Joint Special Representative Brahimi have worked and continue to work towards a political solution to the conflict through a political transition that includes the establishment of a transitional government and the holding of free and fair elections under the auspices of the United Nations.
Mr. Nisirki said it is urgent the international community comes together to assist the Syrian people build, as early as possible this year, a new and democratic Syria, one where the rights of all groups and minorities are properly protected. There is a search on for an American journalist reported missing in Syria. The French news agency says armed men in northern Syria abducted the freelance contributor. AFP says James Foley last supplied the agency with video material November 21st, the day before he disappeared. The 39-year-old's mother, Diane, and brother, Michael, appeared on NBC's Today Show with Savannah Guthrie to appeal for his release. Diane described the last time she heard from her son.
He called, actually, just a few days before Thanksgiving because my aunt, I have a 104-year-old aunt who had died, and he knew what a loss that was for me, and he called just to say he was sorry and he'd be home soon. He's a freelance journalist. He'd been working in Syria. Needless to say, this is an incredibly dangerous place to do reporting. Do you know anything, Michael, about the circumstances of his capture?
We do. There were some eyewitness accounts. They were taken by some armed gunmen. But beyond that, we don't have a lot of information. I mean, that's one of the reasons we're here today.
That's part of the problem.
Yeah, there's been no contact whatsoever.
None.
Right. Michael, let me ask you, we've seen, unfortunately, these circumstances before, and in many cases, the journalist organizations will say, don't report on it, don't release the name because it endangers the person in captivity. And I know that's something that you followed for a while, mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. You've now decided to switch strategies and go public. Why?
It's pretty simple. After 40 days without information, we felt it was important to make people aware and remind them that Jim's an objective journalist. He's an innocent journalist who is doing his job. and to appeal to the people that are holding him, you know, to release him safely, release him unharmed. And also, because of the lack of information that we have, I ask, you know, people to go to the website that we have set up, freejamesfoley.org, to provide us information if they have any.
What should people know about Jim? I mean, this is somebody who obviously is quite courageous if he's going into these active war zones and reporting.
He's a very passionate young man. You know, he's very interested in people, a really good listener, and really cares, particularly about the vulnerable ones, the children in the midst of the war, and the civilians in the midst of it all.
I understand that his background is actually in education and teaching. How did he make the turn and become a journalist?
Well, I think he's always been involved in writing and photography.
Always.
And he cares about the human story. So I think it was a natural combination, really.
That's so true.
And what kinds of efforts, to the extent you can talk about it, have you undertaken to try to learn more about where he is, to get the word out?
We've done a lot. But fortunately, I mean, Jim is a freelance journalist. Global Post is an organization that, you know, he's done a lot of work for. And they've really stepped up. Their CEO, Phil Balboni, has really, really stepped up to put an organization behind Jim. But we've turned over every rock, as you can imagine.
Well, Diane and Michael Foley, I can only imagine these are incredibly tense times for you. I should mention, this happened in Libya. He was covering the situation in Libya and disappeared for a period of 30 days.
That's right.
But he was sighted then. We have not even seen him. You know, no one has witnessed him since he was kidnapped.
It's very different.
It's very different that way. We don't know who is holding him, and we really need to hear from Jim.
Diane and Michael Foley speaking today on NBC Television. Pope Benedict is calling for a halt to the endless slaughter of civilians in Syria. In his annual State of the World address to global diplomats, the pontiff also condemned terrorist attacks against Christians in Nigeria and violence in Mali. Sayla Hennessy reports from London.
In his annual address, Pope Benedict said his thoughts are first and foremost with Syria, where civil war has raged for 21 months.
Je pense d'abord à la Syrie, déchirée par des massacres incessants.
He says he's appealing for a ceasefire and for the start of constructive dialogue to bring the conflict to an end. Diplomats from nearly 180 countries and organizations from around the world listened to the Pope's address in the Vatican. The pontiff pressed diplomats to alert their governments to the need for aid to cope with Syria's humanitarian situation. The United Nations estimates more than 60,000 people have been killed since the conflict began. Pope Benedict also said he hoped for peaceful coexistence between Israelis and Palestinians and for peace and religious reconciliation in Iraq and Lebanon. Turning to sub-Saharan Africa, Pope Benedict highlighted the plight of Christians in Nigeria.
Intervalles réguliers, le Nigeria est le théâtre d'attentats terroristes.
He says he was deeply saddened to learn that even in the days when Christians were celebrating Christmas, some were put to death. On Christmas Eve, gunmen attacked a church in northeastern Yobe State, killing six people. Yobe is next to Borno State, the home of Islamic radical sect Boko Haram, which has attacked churches at Christmas in recent years. The Pope also called for the international community to address the situation in Mali, where Islamist militants have seized control in the north of the country. Rights groups say the militants have committed a range of abuses, including public executions and amputations, aimed at imposing a strict form of Islamic law. The pontiff also said he hoped peace talks in the Central African Republic, where rebels have seized control of one-third of the country, will spare civilians from reliving the throes of another civil war. Sayla Hennessy for VOA News, London.
Bahrain's top court has upheld prison sentences against 13 opposition figures charged with plotting to overthrow the Gulf state's minority Sunni rulers in a 2011 uprising. In ruling Monday, the court rejected appeals from all 13 dissidents, most of whom are majority Shiites. Eight of the defendants had been sentenced to life in prison by lower courts, while the other five had received terms of 5 to 15 years. In Washington, U.S. State Department spokesperson Victoria Nuland reacted Monday.
We regret today's decision by the Bahraini Court of Cassation to uphold the convictions and the sentences of these 13 activists. We're concerned that this decision further restricts freedom of expression and compromises the atmosphere within Bahrain for reconciliation. We have repeatedly voiced our concern about these cases, both publicly and privately and at the highest levels, and urged the government of Bahrain to abide by its international obligations. And we have also had embassy observers at the trial. So we call on the government of Bahrain to investigate all reports of torture, including those made by the defendants in this case, as it is pledged to do, and to hold accountable any who are found responsible.
The opposition activists were convicted of forming terrorist groups to overthrow Bahrain's ruling Al-Khalifa family and engaging in intelligence contacts with foreign powers. A reference to Shiite-majority Iran and Lebanese Shiite militant group Hezbollah. Iran denies providing anything more than moral support to Bahraini Shiites. The Bahraini dissidents helped to launch mass anti-government protests in February 2011, demanding democratic reforms and an end to the Sunni monarchy's perceived discrimination against the Shiite majority. The main Shiite opposition group responded to the upholding of the dissidents' prison terms by accusing the government of political persecution. Human Rights Watch has also come out strongly against the Bahraini court decision. We spoke with HRW's Tamara Al-Rafai.
We are shocked. We are shocked that a military court can convict dissidents only for exercising their right to free expression and their right to assemble peacefully. This is a right that is upheld by many conventions and many treaties that Bahrain is party to. So we are shocked.
These sentences that these people were given, some of them are rather stiff penalties.
Yes, they're very stiff because the court, what the court just confirmed is a life sentence to eight of the 13 people, and the other prisoners will have to be detained for 5 to 15 years. So it is very, very much, and it's excessive for, as I said before, just exercising their right to free expression.
And there's no other route to try to get this reversed, is there?
No, because at that level of the legal food chain, we're already at the top, which is why Human Rights Watch is shocked that this is happening, that it is irreversible, and despite conclusions by the Bahrain Independent Commission of Inquiry, which presented its recommendation to the country over a year ago about accountability and human rights abuses. The pattern continues. The systematic abuse continues. The excessive use of force against protesters continue, and there's very little accountability. On the security forces and other government authorities who commit these serious violations.
Well, what do you hope will be done since we've expired the courts?
We hope that the authorities will review their approach to peaceful protests. As I said, Bahrain's party to several human rights treaties. It is party to the International Convention Against Torture. So extracting confessions under torture is not allowed. Using excessive force and shooting at protesters is not allowed. And having security forces get away with it is absolutely shocking to us. And one example is that, yes, there has been some reform and there have been some steps taken, including sentencing one police lieutenant to 7 years for the crime of having shot and killed a protester.
Tamara Al-Rafai, spokesperson for Human Rights Watch in New York. A court in Kuwait has sentenced a man to 2 years in prison for insulting the country's ruler on Twitter. Anzi, who has 5,700 Twitter followers, was expected to appeal. Kuwait, a U.S. ally and major oil producer, has been taking a firmer line on politically sensitive comments aired on the Internet. At the State Department briefing Monday, spokesperson Victoria Nuland was asked about Anzi's sentencing.
We call on the government of Kuwait to adhere to its tradition of respect for freedom of assembly, association, and expression, all of which are enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, to which Kuwait is a party. You know how strongly we feel about locking people up for their use of Twitter.
In June 2012, a man was sentenced to 10 years in prison after he was convicted of endangering state security by insulting the Prophet Muhammad and the Sunni Muslim rulers of Saudi Arabia and Bahrain on social media. Kuwait has avoided Arab Spring-style mass unrest that toppled three veteran Arab dictators last year, but tensions have intensified between the hand-picked government, in which ruling family members hold the top posts, and the elected parliament and opposition groups. Press Conference USA has taken an in-depth look at the ramifications of the Arab Spring. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke about the issue with Daniel Brumberg, a senior advisor on political reform in the Middle East and the wider Islamic world at the U.S. Institute of Peace.
It seems that Egypt, Libya, and Tunisia have missed the train of transitional justice. How did that derail the transition to democracy, in your opinion?
I think it's premature to say the train has been derailed. It's certainly wobbly, but it hasn't been derailed yet, particularly in Tunisia. We're going to wait and see. I think that in the case of Egypt, your question is apt in the sense that from the perspective of Morsi and the Muslim Brethren, the first thing they needed to do to pursue their agenda was neutralize the challenge from the military. And they've done that quite successfully so far. And in so doing, the transitional justice issue has certainly been pushed aside. In the case of Nakhda in Tunisia, you have a government that's democratically elected, one that has tried to pull in secular groups as well. And the leadership of the Nakhda Party has been trying to put into place a transitional justice program. The Minister of Transitional Justice and Democracy is himself a victim of the previous authoritarian regime. Of course, he has met resistance from within elements of the Interior Ministry, not the military, the Interior Ministry, and elements of the Justice Ministry itself. But there the struggle goes on, and I would say it's premature to say that it's been derailed. In Libya, of course, you have the question of transitional justice, which is only beginning to be addressed now. And the challenge there is that you have militias with arms, a weak national army, and those militias will feel that they have to take the issue of transitional justice into their own hands. So there's some real concerns. Each one of these countries, as you well know, has its own individual dynamics. The great challenge about the Arab Spring or the Arab uprisings is the challenge of generalizing in a way that's meaningful without doing an injustice to the differences and the particularisms of each place.
But you argued that security sector reform hinges on achieving democratic reforms such as electing a parliament and drafting a new constitution in Egypt. Do you see that reform is coming soon with the current political polarization between Islamists and seculars?
I think the polarization is definitely disrupting the process for both security reform and transitional justice. Both of those issues are organically linked. That's in part because particularly secular groups, used to look to the military to protect them from the majority. And in the old kind of protection racket politics of the Arab authoritarian state, a lot of groups looked to the state to protect them from the possible outcomes of a process of democratization. Now that we have the possibility of Islamists exercising authority democratically, but also in a hegemonic way, that is, in a way that excludes the seculars from the political arena, secularists feel vulnerable, and they are not necessarily looking always for transitional justice. Some of them may hark back to the old days in which they were protected by the previous regime. So I think the secular Islamist split has definitely a weakened dynamic over transitional justice, because you need a consensus and you need a sense from all players that the state will protect their interests. And that is not the current perception of many groups in the Middle East.
Daniel Brumberg, Senior Advisor, Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention at the U.S. Institute of Peace. President Barack Obama's nominee for his next defense secretary has caused jitters in Israel and hope in Iran for practical changes. The Speaker of Israel's parliament, Reuven Rivlin, says he is worried about the nomination of former Republican Senator Chuck Hagel because of his stance toward Israel. But Rivlin added that ties between Israel and the U.S. remain strong and one person does not determine policy. In Iran, Foreign Ministry spokesman Ramin Mamaparast said Tehran was hopeful that Hagel's confirmation would lead to practical changes to U.S. foreign policy, Hagel's positions on Iran's nuclear program and relations with the Palestinians appear to be at odds with the Israeli government, and his critics fear his appointment would increase pressure on the Jewish state. This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.